Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, I'll be joined by funny man Will Durst for a good part of the hour. I'll be talking about his upcoming events and the general clown car political scene that's going on at the moment. We'll hear about some of the many festive cultural happenings in the Bay Area, including the witty Scrooge in Love at 42nd Street Moon, various concerts at the Davies Symphony Hall involving the San Francisco Symphony, including a screening of It's a Wonderful Life and a Broadway Christmas with Brian Stokes Mitchell. And Magnificat's conductor, Warren Stewart, is back to talk about that ensemble's performances of Baroque masterpieces this weekend, joined by tenor Brian Thorsett. Also, Peter Robinson reports on the London theater scene and some local events to catch in the weeks ahead. Stay with us. Part of a Bach chorale Fantasia, which will be part of the concerts this weekend presented by the San Francisco Early Music Society and its annual holiday concert the weekend of December 11th, with return engagement by Magnificat Baroque Ensemble. Under the direction of Warren Stewart, for over 20 years, Magnificat has recreated historical liturgies, performing great works from Monteverdi's Vespers to Charpentier's Midnight Mass in their intended musical context. This season, Magnificat stages Johann Sebastian Bach's Mass for Advent. Joining me in studio once again to talk about the concert is the maestro himself, director Warren Stewart, who has established himself as one of the most dynamic and engaging early music specialists in America, as joined also by one of the tenors that's going to be performing, Brian Thorsett. Such a surprise appearance by Brian and a repeat engagement by Warren. Welcome, gentlemen, to the studios.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Thank you.
Brian, you've been doing some stuff out on the East Coast, and now you're coming back for a few performances here. That's fantastic.
Sure have. And I've been back and forth between the coast for several months now and moving out to Virginia, and just keep on coming back because you can't keep me away.
Nice. And Warren, this Mass for Advent, first day of Advent was what, last week or so?
It was 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Lapsed Catholic that I am, I am not exactly entirely on board with that. Anyway, so why this particular work and when did you first hear it?
Well, I should say the Mass, the setting of the Kyrie and Gloria by Bach, is not specific to Advent. It's the nature of the Mass movements, the so-called ordinary, that they can be used on any Sunday or any the Mass of any day. But we're organizing the program around the liturgy for the first Sunday of Advent. That's the beginning of the church year, and it was also the beginning of when Bach came to Leipzig, where we associate him. That was the beginning of his cantata cycles, always started with Advent, and it's wonderful music. So there's also a cantata on the program that is specific to that day. And the piece that we just heard is, as you mentioned, a chorale fantasia. It's over the chorale Nun komm der Heiden Heiland, which is, in fact, the chorale for the first Sunday of Advent. And it occurs frequently over the course of the program, both in the cantata and in organ settings, and in one point, the congregation will, in fact, sing a couple of verses.
Well, you're doing it in a unique way. Was this the original intention of Bach to have just one on a part?
Well,
or was it done various ways?
I mean, there's a certain amount of controversy around this. You can imagine how heated the debate becomes in musicological conferences. But in fact, it was about 30 years ago at a conference in Boston where...
I imagine that's the only place it would be a heated
Exactly. Precisely. No, there's... there's a sort of generally accepted notion that Bach's choral music was done with maybe three or four sopranos, three or four altos, three or four tenors, so forth, that sort of size, and that the orchestra was smaller than a modern symphony orchestra, certainly, but nevertheless had multiple violins on a part and multiple violas playing the viola part. But there's a scholar named Joshua Rifkin, who about over 30 years ago, now it still seems radical and revolutionary, but examined the evidence and, for me, made a very compelling argument, and many other people too, that, in fact, Bach's music was performed with just one soprano, one alto, one tenor, one bass, and likewise with the string parts and the oboe parts, based on a lot of boring evidence. But I think for a lot of people it was a challenge to the way they did things, especially for choirs. You know, it's, oh, you're taking away Bach from me. But I find the evidence pretty compelling. For us, we're a group that specializes in 17th century music, and all of which we do one and apart, and this really doesn't seem that different. I mean, yeah, of course, stylistically it's different. It's a genius composer and all that, but there's nothing about it to me that that says this needs to be done with a gigantic choir. On the contrary, actually, it's such intricate and detailed music. It actually, I think, benefits from the more transparent texture.
Well, we're actually going to hear a little bit of a compare and contrast, mm-hmm. aren't we?
Exactly.
What's the movement that we're going to hear first, and how is it orchestrated?
Yeah, this is the last section of the Gloria, setting the text Cum Sancto Spiritu. And first we're going to hear a very excellent performance with Philippe Herwege in the Collegium Vocale Gent. And they... they're, as I described, I don't know exactly, but I think it's probably about four sopranos, four altos, four tenors, four basses, and, you know, a small, but nevertheless, multiple-voiced instrumental ensemble.
And that'll be followed immediately by the smaller chamber version.
Maybe we'll take just a second in between the two, and I'll say
so
what that is.
Let's hear that first, and then more with Warren's.
So now, as in contrast, this is a recording by the Purcell Quartet, and this is just four singers and two violins, a viola, cello, and violone, and the organ.
From the G minor Mass of Johann Sebastian Bach, to be performed by Magnificat this weekend. Yeah, Warren, it's very much so in a more intimate setting with just having the one on a part, but it must also be that much harder for you to control the forces in the blend. You're not depending on more than one person in a section to add a blend. You need to have some fairly fine soloists. Fortunately, you have people like Brian there.
Precisely. I mean, in fact, it gives me much more flexibility, because you're limited when you're when three or four people have, even three or four have to coordinate, much less a really big choir, have to coordinate, they're restricted in how flexible they can be. Everything has to line up and be exactly the same. You can't really, but like this, everyone's just singing as a soloist. It's like, it is chamber music. It's not only like chamber music, but, and so we're not doing this because we think it's right or it's the way Bach did it. We're doing it because it's actually, I think, much more effective musically.
Mm-hmm. But my point also is that you've also got to therefore be very careful with those individuals that you compile together for these Magnificat performances to make sure that they all do blend well together.
Indeed.
Yeah. And fortunately, as I mentioned, we have someone like Brian Thorsett as part of the mix. Brian, you're such a versatile performer, everything from contemporary art song to opera to Baroque masterworks. Is your heart all over this music, or do you have a weakness for one particular genre?
Oh, that's such a tough question because, you know, I always say that my one great regret in life is that I won't be able to sing all the music that there is out there. You know, there's always that hidden masterpiece that you're going to find, and I can't put my heart anywhere. With this music in particular, you know, there's just this unique and exhilarating challenge to singing it one on a part. You know, when you have a chorus and you generally have a very small piece of text that you repeat over and over and over again, so when you have a huge chorus, they really can't exploit all the colors of that small chunk of text.
But you can't hide either. You can't just take a breath wherever you want. It has to be very calculated.
True. And you work at that. But Bach is such a genius composer that he's pretty much given it to you in a lot of the musical gestures. But as a soloist, you get to find all the nuances of these small chunks of text within these huge choral frameworks. Whereas when you sing an aria, you generally have a longer set of text and less repetition. So it's more about the music. I mean, it is about the text. But when you're singing these choral movements, you get to really enjoy this text in a different way it's set. And it's really fun to play off, especially with the other great soloists, to play off. You hear somebody do something and then you kind of imitate it, not only musically, but you can imitate it in the way you caress the text. And it really makes it an exciting adventure. This is walking on eggshells, yes, but it's really exhilarating as a soloist to do that type of music.
Mm-hmm. And Warren, in addition to engaging the talents of Brian, are all your usual suspects reassembled for these Magnificat performances?
They're pretty much familiar people. And Christine Brandis is joining us for soprano. She's sung with us also in September, but she's relatively new for us. Andrew Rader is our countertenor, and he's been singing with us pretty regularly for four or five seasons now. And Robbie Stafford is our bass, and we go back to the 90s. I've worked with him, so they are all familiar.
And the musicians as well, instrumentalists.
Yeah, David Wilson and Anthony Martin and Elizabeth Reed. Our two oboes, since we do 17th century primarily, we rarely, or I don't think ever, have had oboes before. They really weren't using those until right at the end of the 17th century. So Sarah Duvall and Michael Dupre are joining us on oboe, and so they're new.
Warren's.
And I should say most importantly, perhaps, the organ that we played at the beginning, Davit Maroney is joining us and playing organ both in continuo and in the big instrument that we heard at the beginning.
Very
and
nice.
That's a real treat.
And that must be different for you. I mean, you're in three different venues as well, so he must have to make a bunch of different decisions for voicings. And
yeah, it does make a difference. The instruments are quite different. The instrument on Sunday is most appropriately voiced for Baroque music, but there's ways that you can make any instrument accommodate the style, but also, I mean, the way the pedals are laid out and what stops there are different in each one. But organists have to deal with that always because they're always playing on different. They can't carry their organ with them to the,
so to speak,
to the different.
Well, yeah. Ba-dum-bum, where's our drummer? We need a drummer in here. Yeah, okay. That's Warren Stewart. On that note, the director of Magnificat for performances tomorrow in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, Sunday here in San Francisco. Brian Thorsett, what else is on your plate of performances this holiday season and beyond?
Oh, well, tons of messiahs. He's getting born many, many times this season. So I told Warren before I came here, I was singing through some Verdi, you know, and then came and had to switch gears, got off a plane, and 2 hours later was singing Bach one on a part. And
I'm not going to have any sympathy for you. I'm sorry. Right. It's like, good for you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and just a lot of different things. You know, as you said, modern music, doing David Lang's little Match Girl Passion, and then I have several recitals with world premieres of art songs that are written for me. So I'm working closely with a lot of composers, and that's really exhilarating to do it.
Well, you and I were working for a while on a woodwind quintet version of Schubert's Winterreise, which
yes.
we're still hoping to get off the ground
yes.
somewhere. So,
glorious piece.
Good stuff. Well, be sure you're back in town and be sure to look us up for what's coming up. Warren, thanks so much for coming in as well. Tell us what we're going to go out with here.
This is another part of the Gloria, the beginning of the Gloria. And the text is, in fact, Gloria in Excelsis Deo. So this is also from the G minor Mass.
San Francisco Early Music Society presenting Magnificat tomorrow in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and Sunday here in San Francisco at St. Mark's Lutheran Church. Information at sfems.org. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here. Bye.
Gloria from the Advent Mass in G minor here this weekend with Magnificat under the direction of Warren Stewart, sfems.org for more information about this weekend's concerts. Well, joining me for the rest of this hour is someone that the New York Times called possibly the best political satirist working today. Well, I'll take out the possibly myself and welcome Will Durst back to our airwaves to discuss the endlessly amusing clown car political scene as it rolls through the country and all of its jaw-dropping, this can't be real surrealness. Welcome back.
They're letting actual clowns emerge from the clown car now. It's great.
And they all still seem to fit into the vehicle, too. That's what's most surprising.
Well, at one time there were 17. Running, 17 Republicans. I think it's down to 14 because
they're not running out of money.
Scott Walker.
They're getting unlimited amounts of money. But
well, Walker could have, yeah. But he had to go back and ruin Wisconsin. So he had a job. And who else dropped out? Rick Perry, because he was wearing the glasses to make him look smart. That is so Texas.
Fail. And,
fail. Epic fail.
Well, this political season is now full-time, thanks to this 24-hour news cycle. Is that good news for someone like you? Or does it, is it get a little bit overkill?
You know, the funny thing is, being a political comic, everybody says, you know, the opening statement, oh, you must be having a field day with Trump. But the problem with Trump is, how do you parody a parody? I mean, it's already, I do this joke where I say, you know, it's been days since Trump insulted somebody. I hope he's okay. And I get a laugh at that. But I haven't been able to do that joke for weeks because he's been insulting somebody every day.
And the problem is people are paying attention to him, which what is scarier are the people that are supporting him rather than he himself, you know. And it makes you wonder what kind of, you know, people with pitchforks and torches are going to be coming to the polls. With the haystacks and all that.
How many of Trump's people are actually going to be able to figure out a ballot? You know,
well, so, there's that. Yeah. There's that. Congratulations, by the way, for the terrific reviews on your solo show, Boomeraging.
Sounds like
it's going to have a little bit more life to it.
I'm still doing it. I'm looking for a place to park it, you know, to plant it for a couple of months, but not till 2017, because next year, 2016, the quadrennial. That's my métier.
You're going to be a busy guy just commenting on the things that are going on here.
It's crazy.
Now, your CD, Elect to Laugh, was more about the 2012 election.
It was all
cycle,
about
right?
the 2012.
Now, did that coincide with your radio show with former Mayor Willie Brown, or was it just coincidental that it were happening around the same time? You're doing now. How did that show come about, by the way, Will and Willie?
Paul Wells. A lot of people from the Bay Area may remember Paul Wells. He had a long, storied career, and as the Rock Lobster, and he was down in San Jose, he was in New York, he was here in San Francisco, and he put it together, me and Willie Brown, and it was the Willie and Wells show. And then Paul decided to take more of a producer, and so he fell into the background, and we had a morning show, Will and Willie, for a year.
Did Willie insist on being paid in cash so he wouldn't be able to trace the money?
No, but because they did kind of, you know, throw us a little coin, and we just, you know, the first year, you know, to get it planted. And so he was only obligated to do 3 days a week. But he loved it so much that he showed up every day. And we had a great run. It was on the Air America affiliate here. And the 4 a.m. wake-up call killed me. Because I'm a comic, man. I have gone to bed after 4 a.m. more often than I have gotten up at 4 a.m. Yeah. So, but they pulled the plug after a year. And Air America kind of... Because you guys fill the era, you know... I mean, you got you and the other station here, the public, and it's kind of that political mentality without the bombast and without the commercials.
Oh, yes.
So
thank you very much.
I think that's, we have two great NPR stations here in the 415, or, you know, the greater Bay, the 97 County. So it's, Air America was kind of superfluous. I think that was the problem.
What I didn't realize until recently is that a lot of your political satire is informed, no doubt, by being a politician of sorts yourself. Tell us about your run for mayor of San Francisco.
Oh, it was 100
was that?
Years ago.
Oh,
it was literally, it was 38 years ago, 28 years ago.
Really?
1987.
Well, you came in fourth, I heard.
I came in fourth out of 11. I got 2% of the vote. I spent $1,500, and the three guys who beat me out, Roger Boaz, John Molinari, and Art Agnos, each spent $1 million.
Oh, my gosh.
At a minimum. So on a dollar per vote basis, I am mayor of San Francisco.
Good for you.
But it doesn't work that way.
No, no. And what inspired you to go forward with something like that, knowing the pitfalls and knowing what that office is all about?
Someone dared me to run, and I was working a lot in the Bay Area, and that was when there were five comedy clubs in San Francisco. So I was at one or the other almost every other week. So I just took my petitions, and I got all my signatures at the comedy club. So I was able to get I forget what it was, 3,500 signatures or something, which meant I only had to spend $1,200 for the filing fee. Today, you know, it's like 20 grand if you don't get like 8,000 signatures. So it was a lot easier to do. Mm-hmm. But then I would go to the candidate forums and, you know, give out my little platform, and people would be appalled. They would recoil because they took it so seriously. And it was kind of, I, 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 kind of pulled back after that. I didn't want to offend the little old ladies who had no idea that I was doing it ironically.
Well, we'll be talking with you throughout this hour, and feel free to chime in with the guests that are appearing throughout the rest of this
hour. Yeah, we get a great guest right here, am I right?
Yeah, we're going to also talk about your Big Fat Year and Kiss Off Comedy Show 23, so stay tuned, fellow listeners. Well, hopefully you've caught or will catch the terrific ACT production of A Christmas Carol, featuring the great James Carpenter in the role of Ebenezer Scrooge, now through the 27th. But you only have through this weekend to catch a unique sequel to the story. It's the world premiere of Scrooge in Love, starring Jason Graw in the title role. Pleased to welcome Jason to as the Merry Miser himself to our open airwaves. Jason, on the other side of the country, has starred on Broadway in A Grand Night for Singing, Falsettos, Stardust, Snoopy with three exclamation marks, and Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really Reflect Up?
Of course. My greatest hour.
I love that play.
Out here on the left coast and slightly to the south, he won two Drama Desk Awards in L.A. and has been seen on television, including episodes of 6 Feet Under, PBS specials, all kinds of wonderful things. And now here he is as Ebenezer Scrooge. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks. Great to be here, Dave. Thank you.
Well, we have these ingrained perceptions of certain characters. The miserly Ebenezer Scrooge, the mean one, Mr. Grinch, were we to describe those characters in our own mind. But the reality is just the opposite. By the end of these stories, these characters are reformed. Mm-hmm. And it maybe should be the good ones and the goodness of them we remember.
That's what one hopes. And that's what the creators of this, our show, Scrooge in Love, have done, is taken the transformed Scrooge. And this is a sequel a year later, after he has had his soul saved. And the ghosts come back to him and say, you know what? You're calmer, nicer, happier Scrooge, but you're lonely, and you need to find love in your life.
Okay, so and, I gave a bit of a tease of the storyline, not having needing something more in life. But give us a little bit of a synopsis, if you will, then.
Well, it's 1 year later, it's Christmas, and Jacob Marley comes back and visits him, and this time Scrooge is like, again? You're back again, for God's sake. And he's been through it all before, so it's not quite the terror since he went through all that last year. But it's a little more of the inconvenience and what the hell are these guys doing again to me? And I have to tell you, this is one of the most charming pieces I've ever been in my life. And the guys that wrote it, Larry Grossman, who I did Snoopy with three exclamation points,
right.
He wrote the score for it, and he's a brilliant Broadway songwriter who wrote Grind and Doll's Life and Minnie's Boys and, Good Time Charlie. Fabulous, fabulous shows. And Dwayne Poole, who's written about a bazillion TV movies and musicals, and Kellen Blair. They've just put together one of the most charming pieces I've ever been part of.
I should say the Emmy Award-winning Larry Grossman as the composer.
Yes, yeah, yes, indeed. Yeah, they're fabulous.
So while you were working on Snoopy, when did the germ of Scrooge in Love form? It's a world premiere that we're doing here.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure. It wasn't around during Snoopy. During Snoopy, I was a juvenile and certainly was not thinking about, you know, playing old parts at that point. I have to tell you, when they called me to offer me this job, I thought, come on, you guys, I'm a little young for Scrooge, let's face it. And so then I Googled him, and Scrooge is actually they say he's like in his early 50s. You know, like 51, 52, something like that. So actually, I'm too old to play Scrooge. So that was really...
Well, we have Will Durst there. young at heart, Will Durst.
No one held Christmas deeper in his heart than Ebenezer Scrooge.
I feel another Marsh show coming on.
How long is the little production?
We run through Sunday. We've had a brilliant three-week run, and Sundays are closing. And it's really just... It's just gotten across the board rave reviews. It's just so much fun. And what's been challenging is to take this iconic character of Ebenezer Scrooge, which everybody knows is this old curmudgeon. And in this show, He's fun. I have a song called Happier, and he's perky Scrooge, and he's lovable Scrooge. But there's still the old Scroogeisms in there. He's not completely transformed. So finding the balance of honoring this brilliant Dickens character and of how he has transformed now has been a great, great challenge and a complete ball.
So you can take the miser out of Ebenezer, but not the Ebenezer out of the miser.
Something like that. Yes, that's it. I like it.
Well, tell me about your castmates.
Oh, you know, they're a bunch of hacks.
you know, you work with what you work with. You know, you just take what you can get.
It's truly, this company is spectacular. The ghosts are all amazing. Elise Youssef is the ghost of Christmas Past, and she is a doll. She's like a cross between Goldie Hawn and Billy Burke. And Will, who I can't think of his last name, he's the ghost of Christmas Present and the Force of Nature, with a very great chest. And
well, that's worth the admission price.
I would say that many people would agree with you on that. And Ryan Drummond plays Jacob Marley, and he's done a lot in the San Francisco area, and he's fabulous.
Will Springhorn.
Will Springhorn, thank you so much. He's larger than life and a babe magnet, and I couldn't love him anymore. And my girlfriend, Scrooge, if you remember, had a girlfriend that mm-hmm. he kind of...
That he danced with.
Danced with, and it didn't quite go as well as he thought. He kind of opted for, you know, figures and money over her figure. And her name is Melissa Reinertsen, and she's just fantastic. And it's really beautiful. If you can, I would tell everybody, we've got 4 more shows, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And there's a few seats left. I know Sunday's sold out, but it's very well attended this week. But it's great. And I love the 42nd Street Moon. I don't know if you've been to
shows. Where is it?
It's at their theater is at the Eureka Theater down at the Embarcadero. Mm-hmm. And but they're a company that is so true to their original mission. Greg McKellen started this in 25 years ago, and it was to basically revive old musicals that nobody ever does. Musicals from the 20s and 30s and 40s that people don't know. And they've stayed true to that mission, and I love these guys so much. And they do fabulous productions, and they honor the incredible tapestry of musical theater. And companies like this are dying all over America. But this one in San Francisco is holding on, and I couldn't be prouder to be part of it.
That's Jason Graw as Ebenezer Scrooge in the 42nd Street Moon's world premiere of Scrooge in Love. Remaining performances through this Sunday. Information at 42stmoon, 42ndstreetmoon.org with the 42 with numbers. How does it?
That was good, Connor.
Good.
You're coming along.
Thanks for coming in, Jason.
Thanks for having me. Thank you for having me.
More with Will Durst shortly on this semi-sleigh bill edition of Open Air. Letting you know of a number of fascinating and wonderful things to fill your calendar along the holiday end of things. The San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, Holligays Are Here, is going to be at the Norris for 3 performances. And of those 3, only this Saturday's 2:30 concert has tickets remaining. San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Connie Champagne channels Judy Garland at the Oasis for Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas on December 19th. Classic Nutcracker at the San Francisco Ballet beginning next Wednesday through the 31st. And the Oakland Symphony, Let Us Break Bread Together, a choral tribute to Frank Sinatra, is this Sunday at 4 o'clock, celebrating the 100th anniversary of Old Blue Eyes, one of the most versatile and popular American icons of the 20th century. At 4 o'clock, the Oakland Symphony will be joined by the Mount Eden High School Choir, the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir, as well as the Oakland Symphony Chorus, and Vocal Rush from the Oakland School of the Arts, as well as the klezmer band Kugelplex. So, gosh, at the Paramount Theater this Sunday at 4, the Oakland Symphony with Michael Morgan. Back to some fun facts with Will Durst here in studio with me for the rest of this hour. Will?
What are you going to see this between now and Christmas?
Oh, gosh, I really want to catch Scrooge in Love now that I've heard about it.
Sounds
I'm trying
like
to
fun.
Do that. Yeah, some choral music is coming up on Saturday that I'd like to catch. And then The Smuin Ballet, I should mention also, their concerts are coming up in Mountain View this weekend, and then they're here at the Yerba Buena Center through the 27th. Really, their Christmas program is just really a lot of fun. They do some first half that's more traditional, and then in the second they just go nuts and do all kinds of really fun stuff.
The snowflakes?
I bet you there are snowflakes involved.
I bet there is. We're going to see, because Debbie, my wife, who is much funnier than I am, she did ballet when she was a kid, and so we're going to see the Nutcracker. And then we're doing a theater night, so we're going to go see Potted Potter, or that Harry Potter thing at the Palace of Fine Arts. Because big Harry Potter fans.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. So we got a busy, but then on the 26th is when our big fat year-end kiss-off comedy show starts. So we're kind of stuck between the 26th and the 3rd. We're doing 11 shows in 9 different cities.
Perfect segue. Yeah, tell me about that. How did these venues get set up? And you're like all over. You're going to be on a road trip.
Debbie produces it. Yeah, each theater has a different booking policy, and some of them need insurance and different promotions. So it's a month long enterprise for her. We start out the 26th, Walnut Creek. And then
you're off to Pleasanton.
Pleasanton at the Firehouse Arts. Right. And Monday, I think we're doing Freight and Salvage.
Freight and Salvage on the 28th.
Tuesday, the Hot Monk.
Up to Nevada.
And then Wednesday, Martinez. And then Thursday, New Year's Eve, we do 2 shows in San Jose at the theater on San Pedro Square. And we're doing a 6 o'clock and a 9 o'clock show. And the 9 o'clock show ends at 11. So we're doing Mountain Time New Year's.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, the San Jose performances will also include some free champagne and an interactive balloon drop.
An interactive balloon drop.
That Debbie, she's like on top of these.
You know what happens with the interactive balloon drop? We blow up.
They're not water balloons.
We bring out balloons to the audience, and they blow up their own balloons, and we call it interactive. But they love it, and we push them back and forward. It's a lot of fun. They love it. They have it. And then on the 1st, we do the Hangover show in Mill Valley, and then the 2nd, we're in Half Moon Bay, and then at the Coastal Rep, and then the 3rd, we end up in Alameda Rhythmics.
And on the 11th day, he rested.
Yeah, then we take a day off, and then we go to Hawaii for a week.
Nice.
Yeah.
So this is billed as 6 comics, 9 cities, 10 shows. Tell me about your fellow comics.
It's a pretty all-star lineup. It's Arthur Gauss, who just passed the bar, so I imagine there'll be a little bit of lawyer humor in there. And we do skits and stand-up. And it's all based on what happened the previous year. So Johnny Steele is the other headliner. And, of course, Mari Magaloni, who's an up-and-coming female comedian. Very funny. Talking about a lot about Trump, because she's of Mexican heritage, so she's got a couple of things to say. And then, of course, Deb and Mike, the improv genius of the slowest rising young comedy duo in San Francisco.
Well, it sounds and like then, a fun lineup. And
yes, oh, it's and we just have fun. You know, we already I did my little top 10 comedic news stories of the year, and of course, there was the lady who claimed to be black, but she was really Caucasian, ran the NAACP. And there were some great stories. There were some awful stories this year. There was so much death and destruction that it was hard to find the top 10 comedic news stories, separating the humor from the rocks.
Do you find that, I don't know, like me, as I'm getting older, the cynicism level is really increasing in my own view of Washington. It's just extraordinary. Like, here we are in our 7-plus years of Obama, and it seems like the opposition doesn't want to give him a chance to succeed at all or even take credit for anything that can be interpreted as positive. Has it always been this way in your perception of opposition in Washington?
I'm just a schmuck comic. I don't know nothing, but...
You're a mayor wannabe.
That's right. I am a mayoral wannabe. But I think you're right, Dave, that it's never been this vitriolic. It's never... And I don't know if it's the money and sucking up to people who's with a lot of neck tattoos, that seems to be what this whole trial. But then 4 years ago, Newt Gingrich was leading the polls at this very time. Mm. And 8 years ago, Rudy Giuliani was leading the polls. So, I mean, we're still 6 weeks away from Iowa. And, you know, calmer heads may prevail.
Is that when it is 6 weeks from now? The Iowa?
Yeah, February 1st.
Wow, okay. Yeah. And that's the first of many.
And then February 9th, February 1st, I believe, is a Monday, and that's Iowa. They're always on a Monday. And then New Hampshire is the following Tuesday, 8 days later. Mm-hmm. And then it's boom, boom, boom. Then it's Nevada, South Carolina, and then Super Tuesday, March 1st. And so within that month.
Rest up in Hawaii, that's all I can say,
Will.
Those
30 days, yeah, that's going to be pretty exciting.
Well, what the other problem I'm having with this whole cycle is that I wouldn't exactly call Hillary Clinton a consensus builder. And she's going to magically go to Washington and make everyone talk to each other after all the baggage that she's got with Bill, his first husband? What's that all about?
And that was her point 7 years ago, you know, when she was running. You know, Obama says he's going to go to Washington and make all these people. You know, I've been in Washington. You know, you don't do that. But people after Bush, you know, people wanted to hear something about, you know, cooperation. And that's why Obama was such a fresh. And I think Hillary, I think the Republicans fell into the Benghazi tiger trap. You know, that when they
were hoping that was going to be it.
Yeah, because. Yeah. Her command of foreign policy was so impressive. It was like a six-hour commercial for the Hillary Clinton president, and I think that had a, you know, but lovable? No, Hillary's not lovable. You know, she's as cuddly as a stainless steel teddy bear.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, with Obama, it's almost like this guy could announce the second coming or the first, depending on your beliefs, and there'd be detractors, you know. Like,
yeah. He could discover a cure for cancer. Republicans would complain he's anti-big pharmaceutical.
And then there are the hard historical facts that we are faced with a long spate of a Democrat in the White House. So I think history is, I don't know. I really don't know what's going to happen.
I don't know. Well, David Brooks, you know, the New York Times columnist, and he's ostensibly a conservative. And 4 years ago, he predicted that the Republicans would nominate a moderate in 2012, and he would lose, and they would rebound from that and nominate a hard right, you know, rhetoric guy in 2016, and he would almost destroy the party. And he seems to be on track on both, because I think a lot of the Tea Party guys thought that the big problem with Mitt Romney was that he didn't promote their philosophies, and that he tried to run, you know, down the yellow line, down the middle of the road.
Will Durst, big fat year-end kiss-off comedy show 23 gets underway on the 26th at the Lesher Theater in Walnut Creek. More information and more with Will as we continue this hour at willdurst.com. Fun website, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Nice.
The Will Durst Journal.
Yeah. Joined next in studio by regular commentator Peter Robinson, who's fresh back from London with some news on the London theater scene and offering some holiday tidbits of his own. Hey, Peter.
Hi, good to be here. And I was just thinking, when I left London just last week, I left the House of Commons at that kind of major debate where Cameron finally got a majority to let the bombers roll. And it finished at 10 o'clock. And I always think the best theatre in England is, in fact, the House of Commons. And I often remember that line, which I think they should use in Downton Abbey. They asked a member of the House of Lords, tell me, sir, what do you do? And he said, nothing in particular, but I do it particularly well. And I think back to Cameron carrying the vote, and the debate finished at 10 o'clock that evening. And I was walking back past Westminster Abbey, across Westminster Square there, and I heard the choir preparing with their Advent carols, Sleeping in Heavenly Peace. And I said to myself, who exactly, as those bombers rolled off from the RAF base in Larnaca, heading on that tricky road to Damascus, who exactly are sleeping in heavenly peace.
And the fact that there has never been peace on earth.
There has never been peace on earth.
Let alone a little goodwill towards
me. And I came back to find out that there had been another massacre here in California. So those are some thoughts. But if I move from the theatre of the absurd, which is the House of Commons and the House of Lords, to the theatre of reality, London is definitely thriving. And the hot ticket is a combination of Judi Dench and Kenneth Branagh playing in Winter's Tale, the great Shakespeare play. And Judi Dench really does play the Iron Lady. It's a story which was written towards the end of Shakespeare's life, a story about forgiveness and revenge, well worth seeing. But around London, you've got a combination of the Happy Theatre. It's pantomime time, so Dick Whittington is back in shape with that great British comedian who really brings old-time British humour, Roy Hudd, to the stage. Cinderella, of course, is in full shape, and they've now revived for the first time Funny Girl. So you've really got a combination of a whole range of different theatres, from the classic, the Shakespeare, to the happy-go-lucky Christmas happenings. If you want a trip, and I'll just speak about it briefly, it's one I highly recommend. Hop on a boat at Westminster Bridge, go upriver, and you'll see the cityscape, the Dome of St. Paul's, up to Greenwich. Greenwich has got the Maritime Museum. It's a great building by Sir Christopher Wren. And they're running a exhibition of a famous diarist, Samuel Pepys.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And he lived through the reign of Charles II, which incidentally was a great time for theatre because it was Restoration theatre. The Puritans were out, Long Hair was in, and Nell Gwynn was thriving. And Samuel Pepys is one of these delightful bon vivants. He liked to eat, he liked to drink, and of course he had his mistresses, and he probably got a heavy dose of the clap on the way through.
And he liked to write about it all.
And he put it all down. He was one of those ones who knew how to express his feelings, because often living in Marin, it's very dangerous to ask anybody, how do you feel, because they damn well tell you. You know? So Samuel Pepys gets it down on paper, and you've got some great pictures and paintings of the period from roughly 1660 to 1689, the Glorious Revolution. But it's also the time of the Great Plague. It's the time of the Great Fire. And this is just a wonderful trip up the river. And then finally, I ended up at Ronnie Scott's, which is in the heart of Soho, one of my all-time jazz favorites. And they were playing some jazz from the 1920s. My foot was tapping, my head was jumping, and in that, they still smoke there, in that smoke-filled room, you could hear the saxophonist come in, and I left as they were playing an old tune called After You've Gone, and it really got me going. So let's hear a little bit of After You've Gone, and then we'll go over to Christmas here in San Francisco.
There's no denying you feel blue, you feel sad, you miss the dearest pal you've ever had. There'll come a time, now don't forget it. There'll come a time when you'll regret it. Someday when you grow lonely, your heart will break like mine, and you want me only. After you've gone, after you've gone away.
After You've Gone, offering Peter Robinson a little bit nostalgia from his recent trip to London. So, Peter, on the holiday front, what's in your stocking?
Well, my hot tip for a theatrical production this week is definitely Word for Word. This is a remarkable company. They take short stories, they literally take them, as the title suggests, word for word, and they bring to life the printed page, and you're sitting there in a small theatre at the Z Space, literally just feet apart from the actors. So in terms of intimacy, in terms of hearing the spoken word delivered with great theatrical style, my tip is a show called Bums, Broads and Broadway. And this is based on the stories of the great New York writers Damon Runyon, Joseph Mitchell, and E.B. White. And I think it's a really soulful experience, because most of these stories were written in the 1930s. It's the time of the Depression. It's very New York, and the dialogue is very New York. But you get that deep sense of community, warm words on a cold evening, which bring you straight into this cast of characters. And you feel you've just left one of the New York streets as the community itself is coming together. I mentioned the Depression and people coming together, and Joseph Mitchell's story, Cave Dwellers, was originally called Up in the Old Saloon in 1938. It first appeared in the New Yorker, and it shows you how people do bring a sense of themselves into life. They're going to enjoy everything despite the fact that times are hard, rations are difficult, and of course booze is at the essence of keeping your warm spirits extra warm. The other story is by E.B. White, and some people may know him as the author behind Elements of Style. And he has a very funny one called Christmas and the Relative Pronoun. It sounds a strange combination. You'll end up smiling and laughing as he goes through it. And it really does bring together how the English, or should I say American language, can be used, two countries kept apart, as George Bernard Shaw says, by a common language. Nothing common, of course, about the English language, but we'll leave the common to the American language. So once again, E.B. White brings a happy twist to great theatre. It's great acting. I highly recommend Word for Word. And the show is running at Z Space down in the lower theatre there, and it runs up until December the 24th. So you've got plenty of time to get tickets for that, and I think you really will enjoy it. Now, on a broader scale, I'm pleased to say around the city there are endless activities which really mean the spirit of Christmas is alive and living. And not far from here, of course, is the Dickens Fair up at Cow Palace. If you want to dress up, get into the spirit. It is as much a fancy dress occasion as it is anything else. And I think you really move back into the 19th century when the word Christmas still had a sense of meaning. We mentioned early on, because I heard those two performers talking about Scrooge returning, but there are two versions of Christmas Carol playing around town. One is the classic one at ACT, highly recommended, but also at the Marin Theatre Company. They too are doing their own Christmas Carol. And again, I think Dickens is a great way for introducing young people to how the story behind all this came to life. There's a chance, too, to see different aspects of Christmas. For example, on December the 12th, if you go down to Fisherman's Wharf, there's a lighted boat parade, quite a glamorous performance on the water where 60 vessels are floating fast and furiously through the waters, bringing their own sense of Christmas cheer. And on 4th Street, there's what they call a holiday happening, 4th Street here in San Francisco, and this gives you an opportunity to contribute books to the homeless. So apart from the music and the carols and a chance for a photo op with Father Christmas, there is that opportunity to actually be part of the giving of the spirit. If you want a winter walk from Stockton Street takes you through food trucks and carolers and all sorts of other things. But for my own kind of celebration, I think what I often think about on occasions like this is about the night before Christmas. And I was thinking about it just in terms of political correctness. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and Sanders a wreck. How to live in a world that's politically correct. His work is no longer would answer to elves. Vertically challenged, they were calling themselves. And labour conditions at the North Pole were alleged by the union to stifle the soul. Four reindeers had vanished without much propriety, released to the wilds by the Humane Society. And equal employment had made it quite clear that Santa had better not use just reindeer. So Dancer and Donner and Comet and Cupid were replaced with four pigs, and you know that's quite stupid. The runners had been removed from his sleigh. The ruts were termed dangerous by the EPA, and people started to call for the cops when they heard sled noises over the rooftops. Secondhand smoke from his pipe had his workers quite frightened. His fur-trimmed red suit was called unenlightened. And to show you the strangeness of life's ebb and flows, Rudolph was suing for the use of his nose and had gone on Fox News in front of the nation, demanding millions in overdue compensation. So Santa in his sleigh to his team gave a whistle, and they all flew away like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, if that's politically all right."
Thank you, Peter, for your insightful prose for the holiday season. And Will Durst, thank you for joining me for this big, fat, almost year-end open
air. Merry, as we say in politically correct San Francisco, may the corpulent bearded one in the scarlet suit smile upon your festive shrubbery.
Well, I don't think I don't have a comeback for that.
Well, he only comes down the chimney, and that's once a year.
Big. All right, the big fat year-end kiss-off comedy show. I think Will's got some material there. Show number 23 gets underway, the 26th, information at willdurst.com. Thanks again for coming in, Will.
Thank you, David.
Lots of other things happening here in the Bay Area on the Christmas front, including a number of things with the San Francisco Symphony. Tonight's the second of two classic Christmases with the San Francisco Symphony. Teddy Abrams conducting works by Vivaldi, Tchaikovsky, Vaughan Williams, as well as Rimsky-Korsakov. And the San Francisco Girls Chorus involved in that performance tonight at 7:30. It's a Wonderful Life with the San Francisco Symphony on Friday and Saturday, with Ragnar Bolin's San Francisco Symphony Chorus participating and Justin Freer conducting. Peter and the Wolf is this Sunday at 1 and 4 o'clock under the direction of Donata Cabrera. He's conducting the San Francisco Youth Orchestra. A Mariachi Christmas, Mariachi Sol de Mexico, I should say, with Jose Hernandez this Sunday at 8 p.m. And The Colors of Christmas with the San Francisco Symphony next Monday and Tuesday. Lots to do and see. sfsymphony.org for more information. I should also mention that tonight at 8 p.m., you want to catch this down at Union Square if you happen to be around. The Fierce and Fa-La-La-Labulous drag queens of the Bay Area return to the Holiday Ice Rink in Union Square for the 6th annual Drag Queens on Ice. Don't miss it. 8 to 9:30 tonight at Union Square. That's something you're going to want to see, people. Also, I mentioned that the Oakland Symphony is doing a Frank Sinatra tribute. Well, also, my colleague Noah Griffin is doing a special Frank Sinatra tribute tomorrow at the new Herbst Theater. Also, on the non-holiday front, the House of Usher is, Fall of the House of Usher is being presented by the San Francisco Opera. Gordon Getty's Usher House combined with Debussy's Fall of the House of Usher. Those remaining performances are tonight at 7:30, Friday at 7:30, and Sunday at 2 o'clock. sfopera.com is the website for that. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks so much for tuning in to Open Air. More holiday show business next week at this same time. A reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. Neil Swinkles produces Open Air. My thanks to Niels, as always. If you've got a show suggestion, send it to me, david@kalw.org. And speaking of Gordon Getty, we're going out with Gordon's arrangement of Silent Night. Again, the Fall of the House of Usher at the San Francisco Opera for a couple more performances. Catch it. This is KALW San Francisco, online at kalw.org.